layoffs be on the horizon at JEA? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5, and this is First Coast Connect. I'm Alyssa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, why Jacksonville's public utility could be facing big changes. What are your questions about the energy industry? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later in the hour, how the city is tackling those algae blooms in our local waterways. Plus, the launch of our new Adapt Florida website. We'll tell you about that, too. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, JEA says it may have to lay off, eventually, hundreds of workers to avoid a big spike in customers' electric bills. David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union has been covering this latest news and joins us now in studio. Hey, David.
Good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for being with us. What are your questions about your JEA bill out there and the potential prospect of layoffs at the utility and some other changes? Give us a call at 549-2937. 549-2937, emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, and tweets to @MelissaInJax. Our Facebook page is open as well. A lot in your latest reporting, David, but let's start with potential layoffs. CEO Aaron Zahn says JEA could avoid a huge spike in its base electric rate for customers, about 70%, if it eventually cuts more than 500 jobs from the utility. That's a big reduction. Tell us more.
Well, what's going on is the JEA is saying that when they look into the future, they see this continued trend of energy efficient products, increasing use of solar power to the extent that people can rely more and more on solar for their electric needs. Mm-hmm. And that's going to mean there's going to be less electricity that's sold by JEA. So it's a basic market change, they say, is happening. And if you are selling less electricity, then any business would look at it and go, well, we either raise the rates to keep our revenue up, or we start to cut back on our expenditures, which means you cut back on your number of employees, which is a big cost at a utility.
Over time, if that many employees were laid off, that would be more than a third of JEA's total workforce, wouldn't it?
Right. So they've been going down for a while anyway. I think in 2006, they had roughly 2,600 employees. That went down and is about 2,100 employees now. Then they would look by 2030 to reduce that by another roughly 600 employees, and it'd be down to 1,600. So, yes, absolutely, there would be a shrinking workforce at JEA, which, let's face it, for a long time was a really stable job to have. You got a job at JEA, and you figured you'd retire at JEA.
Mm-hmm. Not necessarily so anymore.
Not at all.
Here is Aaron Zahn. He appeared on this program on June 4th talking about JEA's need to innovate or die. Let's listen.
This past year, we took some dramatic steps that people wouldn't have expected, announcing our STAR plan about paying off over $1 billion in debt in the next 5 years, executing long-term 250 megawatt solar PPAs. Absent some of those steps that we took as a management team in this past year, we'd be talking about rate hikes now. And so what we've done is bought ourselves some time.
Okay. So in terms of customer satisfaction and the pain utility customers might eventually feel, Aaron Zahn is saying we can hold off these rate increases for now, but unless we make very difficult choices, we can't hold them off forever, right? Mm-hmm.
Right. What he's basically saying, and has not really put the plan on the table yet, is that the way to resolve JEA's difficulties, the challenges they face, is to find new ways to make money for the utility. And so that's the real challenge that he has put before the board. And that's something I expect to talk about more in future board meetings.
Right. He's talking about looking at new lines of revenue, finding other ways to generate revenue at JEA, but his senior leadership is saying they're constrained by regulations. How so?
Well, what they say is that there are limitations on by the Florida Constitution, by state law, and the city charter in terms of how much latitude they have to go into different lines of business. So right now, obviously, they have a monopoly in Jacksonville on electric and water sales. That's their bread and butter. That would still continue to be the main core business. But they're saying there are things that would prohibit them from doing other types of commercial activity, retail-type activity. Now, we don't know yet exactly what they want to do or exactly what changes would be made in the city charter, but that's really where the rub is. I mean, they're talking about stuff like, let's say somebody, the example he uses a lot is, let's say somebody wants to replace their old water heater and get a really energy efficient water heater because they figure that's going to save them a lot of money over time. Well, that's good for that customer. They get their benefit. It's good for the environment. Obviously, less electricity is used. It's not good for JEA because that means they're selling less energy to that customer. So the idea would be, well, JEA would find a way to get into that market and have it where the customer might pay that cost on their electric bill, so to speak. And at the same time, their electric bill is not going up because even it's offset by the savings they're getting on energy. So it's those kind of things that they're looking at doing. If there are more electric vehicles out there, could JEA find a way to have electric vehicle charging stations? Those type of activities that are looking into the future. Right.
Now, some observers have floated the idea that these potential pain points are being brought up by the JEA board and leadership as a way of restarting the conversation of selling off the utility to a private company. What about that?
So Matt Schellenberg, a city council member who has long favored looking at privatization and selling JEA, he said this week that when you listen to the conversation, it sure sounds like they're setting it up, teeing it up to have another conversation about whether there should be some privatization of JEA. And by privatization, we're talking about, you know, large amounts of JEA's assets being sold so that they are now controlled by private entities. It's possible that could be where they end up with this. You know, we don't really know. It's not something they've talked about so far. The real focus has been finding ways to increase revenue, not sell and get out of the electric business or the water business.
What are your thoughts about your electric bill and your water bill at JEA as the utility looks at potential layoffs down the road to avoid huge spikes in customer rates? They may also not move to their planned new headquarters downtown. We'll talk about that, too. It's 549-2937. Scott is on the north side. Go ahead, Scott.
Yes, I'm appalled by the fact that they're coming back later with these problems with JEA. That's the same thing you see with the school board. The leadership problem in Jacksonville is appalling. Now, you come right back talking about we having all these issues with JEA. Why you didn't bring this up? When he spoke with you on PBS about less than a month ago, he didn't talk about these things here.
Let me just say, you're talking about Aaron Zahn appearing on this program on June 4th. Yes. He talked a lot about the need for JEA to change the way it does business. He didn't specifically mention layoffs, though, Scott. You're right about that. That did not come up. He didn't bring that up. He talked in more general terms, though, about in his vision that JEA needs to radically change its ways or it will no longer be viable.
But he was evasive. When you were asking him questions, he was very evasive. He worked for a public city entity. Well, he should have been more open as far as information because you asked him some very important questions that he kept pushing to the side.
Okay,
and
Scott.
That's appalling to me.
And believe me, it wouldn't be the first time I was faced with that on this show with a public official or someone who answers to the public. So, Scott, I appreciate you pointing that out. And I appreciate the CEO of the company coming on the show. He didn't always give straight answers. I think it's fair to say to some of these direct questions, he did talk in vaguer terms, and there may be good reasons for that. That said, the public does want to know what is the future fate of this utility. Jacksonville ratepayers do want to know that. So it's good that you're here, David, as well, to have the conversation.
Yeah, University of North Florida did a poll recently, and it showed overwhelming support for retaining public ownership of JEA. People don't want to give it up. So any talk of changing or the long-term future, it inevitably brings up that question, which is, does this mean that the city is going to try to sell the electric portion or the water portion or all of it to some private entity, and you're no longer going to have local control of JEA. So that's always going to be coming up in the mix. I can just tell you that from covering the board meeting so far, they have not talked about it. It's not been something that's come up for discussion. It's all been focused on here's all the problems we face, and we're going to bring you some solutions that would be about finding ways to get more revenue, because that's the revenue gap that we face.
CJ in Mandarin. Hi, CJ. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. It does appear that JEA, the upper echelon, is looking to sell off aspects of the company. I think that would be very short-sighted. As your guest just cited, public opinion does not want to lose JEA, and it's also a source of recurring revenue to our city. I think a way to avoid having to sell off the company would be really for the business to pivot. And, I mean, for goodness sakes, we live in the Sunshine State, and JEA should really be focusing on trying to, take people's electric bills, and they pay JEA. But instead of going towards fossil fuels, it would be going towards some sort of a lease or a rent-to-own of their solar system, and also like a solar battery. JEA can also focus on industrials, solar batteries and renewable batteries, and really help put a power plant on each individual's home. I mean,
right.
We all saw the hurricane that if people had decentralized energy, we would be online much quicker. We have to adapt.
Yeah, so I hear you, CJ, I take your points. Thank you for that. And now, the CEO, Aaron Zahn, did say on this program, and he's told your organization too, David, within about 10 years, the average homeowner, it will be less expensive for them to do that than to get their power through the utility. They can put solar panels on their roofs, get battery capability in their home, and they are in business in about 10 years.
Right. So, and what the caller CJ was talking about, that pivot, is exactly what JEA's been discussing doing, is making that pivot. And there is this idea out there that right now, if you could put a solar panel on your house, it's great for when the sun's shining. But then if the sun's not shining, you have no way to get solar power. So you rely still on backup power from JEA. So the idea is once you have these battery power where you can store solar energy, then you are much less reliant on your utility company. And when that transition happens, then anybody just puts the pen to paper and says, okay, does it make more sense for me to get solar panels and a battery and power my home with the solar power than it would for me to continue to pay bills to JEA? If the numbers add up, then you go, okay.
How does JEA stay afloat once enough customers decide to make that move?
Right.
You know? And then, look at all the people who've cut the cord with the phone company. They no longer have a landline in their home.
Great comparison. How
does AT&T stay in business when so many people no longer have a landline? Well, they go in new directions. They, as Zahn is saying, you try to find other lines of business if you can.
Right. He uses the expression, you try to ride the trends instead of being at the mercy of them. So these are all sort of interesting concepts, right? But the devil's in the details. What exactly are they going to do? Can they pull it off? And also, is this something that city leaders want their utility to be engaged in? They may say, just stick to your knitting. Deliver water, deliver sewer, deliver electric, do it efficiently, but leave these other changes in the marketplace to the private sector.
Danny is on the east side. Hi, Danny. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Go ahead.
I know my only comment, I agree with the other guy that maybe they should get into the selling or leasing of solar powers and using each home to create energy. But I would be leery to privatize an industry that's a monopoly that's driven by revenue. So they're just going to cost as much as they can, and they're going to increase our prices without any real control.
Okay. Thanks for that call, Danny.
Electric rates have gone up. And obviously, that's one solution. You keep increasing the electric rates. And there's some scenarios where that's exactly what JEA could do in order to...
And they're projecting rate spikes as high as 70%.
Right. I think 71% is how much it went up. So absolutely. There could be a... And it gets a little more complicated because it's your base rate, which doesn't include some costs. It's, you know, if you want to have a vertigo, just look at your bill and try and figure out exactly where all the costs are. But whatever it is, that's a large increase. And quite frankly, it's the same. It's an increase that people have seen in their bills over the last 12 years. So they've already encountered that type of adjustments in their rates.
And at minimum, what JEA is saying is that rates are going to go up by at least 20% to 25%, and potentially a lot more, depending on how they manage this.
Right.
So you can expect rate increases no matter what. It's it's a question of will they be fast or slow or painful or manageable. Jim in Riverside. Hi, Jim. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to find out this new grim outlook from Aaron Zahn coming out this year. I wanted to know, does anyone know how it compares to the evaluation that was done just last year? Wasn't it a little bit rosier? Were they kind of polishing the brass over there to make it look sellable? And now we get this grim view of how, you know, it's going to collapse in 10 years. Does anyone have that comparison?
Thanks for that.
Yeah, I think at the time they were talking about how JEA has never been in better shape.
So why this abrupt change in the narrative? I think is what he's asking.
Right. But they also talked at that time about how there was a lot of mergers and acquisitions going on in the industry and that utilities were facing these changes that JEA's facing. And so the way that they were overcoming that was they were purchasing other companies, getting bigger. There's a lot of companies that have gone out of business over the years. There's a lot of turnover and churn in the market. So they were talking at that time about how things were changing. There was some thought that, well, you know, if all this is going to happen, then you sell. If you're a monopoly, you sell when you're at your peak. So that was some of the argument there.
Lane tweets the show, I'm frustrated. We offer companies tax breaks to bring jobs to town, but won't accept a rate increase to keep 500 plus jobs already here. And why can't JEA go heavy into solar? Here's a tweet from Jim. I don't think JEA is being completely honest about its plant Vogtle costs. The cost of power they agreed to purchase from the Vogtle plant goes up every day. How much impact will that have on consumers? And he's talking about a nuclear deal in Georgia at a plant there that JEA wanted to get out of but couldn't. And so that's another drag on their bottom line, isn't it?
That's right, because nuclear power, it turns out, it's going to cost a lot more than they thought it would when they entered into this contract a decade ago. I don't know how to quantify that. They are trying to pay down their debt, and that would then give them some flexibility in terms of being able to absorb the costs of nuclear power in terms of how that works into their overall rates. I've not seen a real clear explanation of
trying to make that as painless as consumers, but there are going to be changes. That's the takeaway here.
Not next year.
Not right away.
Obviously,
they're
rate increase, but the idea is that they look at these trends and they say, yes, that's going to happen.
All right. And he's David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union. You can read his report today. Pick up the paper or go to jacksonville.com. And up next, the city's plan to battle algae blooms on our waterways. This is First Coast Connect. Back in a moment.
Democrats held their first debates this week, and most of the candidates did great. Of course, with so many, they only had time to say their own names, but most of them got it right. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us as we ask novelist Jennifer Weiner to write a better ending for this whole thing on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday morning at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi,
I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup, where we talk about the biggest stories in the state.
From politics to education, the environment, and more. If it's news in Florida, we want to hear from you.
Let your voice be heard. Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Fridays at noon on WJCT.
JU and Mosh present Above and Beyond, a 90-second shortcast during Science Friday on 89.9 WJCT. Tune in for special Chasing the Moon segments starting now through July 12th.
Hi, this is Keith Marks. Join me every Thursday evening at 11 p.m. for Avant Radio, a show of curious music for curious minds. Each show is themed, curated, and contextualized to explore new music. Come get curious on Thursdays at 11 on 89.9 FM.
Welcome back. Well, the city of Jacksonville is launching a new study and effort to help improve water quality around town. Jacksonville will be one of the first cities in Florida to use a product called MicroBLIFT. Now, the goal with this is to try to reduce algae blooms in waterways, especially stormwater ponds. Melissa Long is chief of the city's Environmental Quality Division and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
And if you have questions about algae and the city's efforts to combat it, give us a call. It's 549-2937. So, Melissa, what is MicroBLIFT?
MicroBLIFT is actually a kind of a bacteria soup type of thing that we'll be adding to the ponds. It's been in use for about 20 years through aquarium cleaning. If you have that green water in your aquarium, mm-hmm. it'll clean it up. Koi ponds, things like that. So now we're actually... The innovative approach for this is adding it to the ponds to see if we can get that total nitrogen, which is the nutrient of interest for the city of Jacksonville, see if we can get that reduced even further.
You're trying to reduce algae blooms that are toxic. They can harm animal, plant life, and humans, too.
Exactly.
They're very toxic, and they tend to crop up, particularly in the summer months. How serious is the algae problem this summer across town?
Well, we have seen algae blooms a little bit further upstream than Duval County. That's typically where we see them once we get that salinity into our water closer to the St. John, closer to the Atlantic Ocean. We don't see it as much, but it is still a problem even here in Duval County. So it's one of the things mm-hmm. we are trying to see. It's not as bad as back in 2005 when we had the green monster. Mm-hmm. We also had a very large bloom in 2010. It's not what we're seeing today. And improvements have been made, but we are not quite where we need to be.
And so you are using MicroLift, targeting spots across the city, one of the first major cities in Florida to do this, correct?
Absolutely. Yes, it is.
And what drove the decision to try this approach?
It's actually part of the Basin Management Action Plan for the Lower St. John's River. The Department of Environmental Protection has an obligation for this area to reduce total nitrogen and total phosphorus in some areas, but for us, it's mainly total nitrogen. We have a huge obligation to make, and we've made quite a bit of that. We've gotten about half of our reduction, which our requirement is 106 metric tons, according to the Basin Management Action Plan. We've done half of that, 53 metric tons, and we've actually done a bit more than that, but our goal is 2023, the end of the year. We have to have met the entire goal, so we have quite a bit of more ways to go. The problem is that conventional methods of treatment aren't quite going to get us there. We're doing the other things that we need to do. We're doing the septic tank phase out with JEA. We are doing stormwater retrofits where we can. Things like that. We're doing street sweeping. All of that kind of helps us with that total nitrogen reduction, but we're not quite going to get there with all of that. So we really need to think outside the box and look at innovative technologies, which is exactly what we're doing. And this is one that we're studying today.
Are there any downsides or risks to using this product?
I don't believe so. We've actually studied this. They've gone through the innovative technology approval from the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. We don't feel that there's any adverse reaction that could happen, but we are testing the ponds to make sure. Mm-hmm. Some of the things we're looking at are there might be metals entrained in the sediments in the bottom of the pond. We want to make sure those don't go back into our water column. So we're testing that as we're looking at these ponds. We've worked very closely with DEP, Department of Environmental Protection, to develop this study to make sure that at the end of it, we have a calculatable difference, hopefully, with this MicroBLIFT product.
And you're targeting ponds, but the overall goal, as you said, is to use this in conjunction with a number of other approaches to improve water quality everywhere, including in the river.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. We have a huge number of tributaries in our city. It's a great city. Anywhere you walk, pretty much, you're going to cross a bridge or cross an overpass that goes over a little stream, river, creek. So we are looking at improving water quality all over the city. Our main focus is the river itself because that's where we have the obligation. But really, when we impact and improve our tributaries, it's going to improve the St. John's River.
There's so much water, Melissa. It's a big job.
It is.
Isn't it?
It is very much a big job. And we work, the Environmental Quality Division works very, very hard.
And reducing nutrients now, you're doing the treatment with Microblift. But a minute ago, you mentioned phasing out septic tanks in conjunction with JEA. In the first segment of this show, we talked about some other challenges facing JEA and the utility industry as a whole. But let's talk about the septic tank phase out too, because that's ongoing. I don't think people realize just how many septic tanks there still are around this area.
There are a large number of septic tanks. I don't know the number exactly. What I hear from the Department of Health is that there's about 60,000 tanks in our area. So we are working to try to phase those out. The JEA partnership that we have with the septic tank phase out now is quite expensive because they're having to actually put mainline extensions in. So it's not the easy connection that you just hook up with a plumber right at the front of your yard. They're actually having to put lines out to these neighborhoods. So it's a lot more difficult. We are doing that, but it gets us some Basin Management Action Plan credit, which is the total nitrogen reduction, but it takes a lot of septic tanks to get mm-hmm. that reduction.
Septic tanks contribute to pollution in the river. People using fertilizer on their lawns that isn't considered river friendly, that contributes to nitrogen.
Yes, it does.
When you don't pick up after your pet, when you take them out for a walk, that seems like a small thing, but that can contribute to pollution in the river. When you mow your lawn and you don't bag up the grass and it goes into the system, that contributes. I mean, there are so many ways that we're all contributing to this problem, aren't there?
Yes, there are. Absolutely. And we do have fertilizer ordinances, irrigation ordinances that are trying to handle that kind of thing. But I think a lot of people don't understand exactly what they're supposed to do and not supposed to do. But yeah, absolutely. Bagging up those grass clippings helps a lot if it's not getting into our storm system. And pretty much anywhere in Duval County, if it gets in the street and it rains, it's going to our stormwater system and then very quickly to a tributary.
Stormwater runoff is a big problem, too. That's something you're managing. And as you conduct this program over the next year, you want the public to be aware of this and avoid certain areas.
We do. Right? We have 9 ponds that we'll be treating throughout the city. Signs are not quite up yet, but they should be up next week to let people know which ones those are. We have a map on our website. If you go to www.coj.net/microblift, the map is there so you can see where these ponds are. We are asking that people do avoid them. We don't anticipate any issues, but we want to make sure we get good quality data as well as not putting anybody at risk.
Sure. Melissa Long, she's chief of the city's Environmental Quality Division, and we thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
There's an art to the apology. Finding just the right sentiment so that the aggrieved party feels solace from your expression of true remorse. But there's also an understanding that for some things, sorry ain't good enough. On the next Snap Judgment, Aftermath. Storytelling with the beat. Do not miss it.
Saturday afternoon at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Join us in celebrating the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, featuring Chasing the Moon events at WJCT and MOSH. Visit wjct.org/events to explore what's coming your way.
Jazz, the Great American Songbook, and your favorite oldies on Relax Radio at midnight, only on 89.9 FM. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, it's a new legal strategy being used in some divorce cases, especially contentious ones. Bifurcation is a way for couples to become officially single before the divorce is final. And it can lower the cost of a divorce, too, by a lot. Ashley Cox is a Jacksonville attorney and founder of the family law practice at the Bedell Firm. And she joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And are you going through a divorce? Do you have questions about divorce? What are your questions about bifurcation? Give us a call at 549-2937. Now, we all know that about half of all marriages end in divorce, and the average cost of a divorce, Ashley, you say, is about $30,000 a couple. That's a basic divorce. A really difficult divorce can cost a lot more. And so bifurcation is something that has emerged in family law recently. How does it work? What is bifurcation?
So bifurcation in a divorce is the legal ending of a marriage before you have all of the issues finalized. So you could get an order from the court to make you legally single and divorced before you have possibly the time sharing or the equitable distribution or all of the issues settled. I will say that judges discourage bifurcation if it's for the sole purpose of becoming single. They do want you to try to have some of the issues resolved before they will enter an order of the dissolution.
This became trendy because celebrities in particular are trying this method, like Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, correct?
Yes, I believe that they, their divorce had been going on for a couple years before they did bifurcate some of the issues and the court entered their dissolution of marriage. But I also believe they did settle some of the issues, and then there are still other issues that need to be resolved. Probably financial issues. It looked like maybe they had some parenting issues that were worked out. And so their divorce was final.
So what are the benefits of going this route? Which divorcing couples does it make the most sense to do this? Which type of divorcing couple?
I think when you have multiple issues that the parties are arguing over, if you can chip away at some of those issues. So when you're going through divorce, you're looking at dividing your assets and liabilities, support issues, child support, alimony, and then also the most important is the parenting plan and time sharing for the children. So if you're arguing over all of those, if you can find one issue where you can agree and kind of chip away at the problems and set that one issue in stone, then it leads to possibly moving to a settlement of the entire divorce. But we could try to take it one at a time and get people to agree on things one at a time. So in contentious cases, it could be more beneficial.
People think of divorce as this binary thing. One day you're married, the next day you're not. But the reality is that it can be a long, drawn-out process, right?
Yes. So really, the shortest divorces take 6 to 9 months.
That's the short one.
Yes. And then if it's contentious, it can go on for years. Because you're, even in the shortest divorces, you have to have full financial disclosure. All of the assets and liabilities need to be known. You need to understand what's going on with the children and what can be worked out. What's in the best interest of the children is really the most important part of a divorce if there are children involved.
How common is bifurcation now in family law? Is it becoming the norm or is it something that's just emerging?
It has certainly been possible for many, many years, but it's not the norm. The judges definitely don't want to just enter a divorce if the other issues haven't been resolved. But I do think judges are open if you have a partial settlement agreement to entering that partial settlement agreement so that some of the issues can get set in stone and people can start to move forward.
Do people want bifurcation so that they can start dating? You know, they can tell potential new romantic partners, I'm single, even though the paperwork doesn't say it yet officially, according to this legal strategy, I'm now single.
I think that people do want that. However, the courts frown upon that. They are not going to enter a bifurcated divorce and make someone single again for the sole purpose that they want to remarry or move on or date. The courts are really only going to look at the bifurcation or accept it if there are financial reasons or if it's in the best interest of the children. But if you just want to go out and date, the courts are not going to just enter your divorce so that can happen.
Jacksonville has a higher than average divorce rate, by the way. We want your calls about this. If you're going through a divorce, you have questions about bifurcation, it's 549-2937. So there are benefits to this, but there are drawbacks too. What are some of those?
So it is very important that if you've been married, once you become single, there are going to be consequences to your health insurance. There could be tax consequences. There could be estate planning purposes. So you really need to, whether you're going to have a bifurcation or not, once you're going to become single, you want to make sure you've consulted with your accountant, you've consulted with an estate planning attorney, and you understand that there could be consequences. One of the biggest is health insurance. It's once you're single, particularly for a dependent spouse, if they're on their spouse's health insurance, they're no longer going to have that health insurance. And it's very important to be prepared for that such that when your divorce goes through, you are covered.
What's the hardest thing about being a family law attorney? Because you're dealing with people every day who are in a lot of pain. Their marriage is ending.
Yes, it is an extremely emotional time for people. And I think the most difficult part of being a family law attorney is just trying to keep calm and keep peace because, understandably, this is someone's life. These are their children. These are their finances. They don't know what their future holds. They're scared. And so it's really important to try to help people not get overwhelmed or completely worked up so that they can see the bigger picture and we can come to an agreement, because closure is really what's most helpful.
Are people sometimes in such a rush to get the divorce done that they don't make good decisions?
Yes, sometimes. And that's why it's really important to have counsel who can say, look, we've got to take a deep breath. We want to make sure we have all of the picture of the finances and the children before we make decisions. Because some people are just, I'm done, I'll sign anything, I'm over it. And you really want to have good counsel and a good attorney who can advise you and make sure that the agreement that you're signing is good for you.
Now, the statistic for years, too, by the way, has been roughly half of all marriages end in divorce. In Jacksonville, it's higher than that, I believe. The latest numbers that I saw, a majority of marriages in this community end in divorce. What do you think it is about Jacksonville that's causing all these people to break up? What's going on?
Oh, no. I don't know. Maybe next year, maybe when the Jags win the Super Bowl, there'll be less divorces.
But then you'd be out of business.
That's
so
right.
That would not be good for you.
Well, that's okay. I would be definitely happy if the statistics could improve.
Right. And with family law, it's interesting how it's changed over the years. This whole field has really changed a lot. I mean, isn't there's now more of a push toward strategies like bifurcation and also mediation? And women are far less likely to get alimony than they used to. There have been a lot of changes over the years.
There are definitely a lot of changes. I've actually seen a tremendous amount of very capable and strong women, and the women have really wonderful jobs. So I actually have quite a few cases where the men are seeking alimony, and so that's definitely a shift. There's also been a shift in the time sharing, and that the courts are leaning much more towards a 50-50 time sharing split with the children, as opposed to kind of the traditional that I grew up with, every other weekend and one, you know, Wednesday night. And mediation is ordered in every single case. And I would say probably around 90% of the cases settle at mediation and keep things less contentious.
Yeah. And bifurcation seems to also help with that, because the angrier the divorce is, particularly if there are kids, the more trauma the kids go through.
Absolutely. So if you can have a partial settlement agreement and have a time-sharing plan for the children and get that entered by the court, then there's consistency for those children and everybody, the family, can start to move forward.
How do your female clients react when their ex-husbands say, I want alimony? Because that's becoming more common.
It is becoming much more common, and it's difficult. No one wants to pay alimony. Neither the woman or the man wants mm-hmm. to pay alimony. Mm-hmm. So it is really an interesting shift. But I'm also so proud when I have a woman come in and she's the breadwinner in the family and doing a fantastic job for her family financially. And so it is an interesting shift. But so they're not excited about paying the alimony, but also I think they're proud of themselves that they're able to provide that for their family.
And haven't advocates for men tried a few times to change Florida law around ending alimony payments, but they've been unsuccessful to do that. Isn't that right?
So there have been efforts to amend the alimony statute in the state of Florida, but they have not passed through
the legislature. So that you wouldn't have to keep paying it past a certain point.
Correct. Yes. The permanent alimony to be shorter and to change the formula of how it's calculated.
Mm-hmm. So far that hasn't happened, but bifurcation is happening. Do you recommend this all the time or just to some clients?
No, we definitely don't recommend it all the time because it's depends on the judge that you have and the court as to whether it's going to go through, but everybody's case is so different. So when they come in, we get all of the details and we figure out what's the best plan for that person and whether a partial settlement would be beneficial.
Every case is different.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, it's a tough topic, but an important one for so many divorcing couples out there. So Ashley, thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Ashley Cox, she is an attorney and founder of the family law practice at the Bedell Firm, bedelllawfirm.com, for more about bifurcation. And speaking of websites, don't go away, because in a moment, we're going to tell you about something we're very excited about here at WJCT. This week, we are launching our new digital project, Adapt Florida. Vital information about how this area is adapting to changes in climate. That is coming up in just a moment. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Keep listening.
Lindsay Kilbride, host of WJCT's podcast, What It's Like. It starts with some of the best conversations recorded in Jacksonville by StoryCorps.
I remember being on the school bus and passing by and seeing you outside. You were under the addiction at the time.
And then I go deeper into the story.
How do you cope with the guilt you still feel? How do you cope with that?
Subscribe to What It's Like from WJCT wherever you get your podcasts.
Robin Young, 20 Democratic candidates are trying to stand out from the crowd in two batches, in two debates. Will frontrunner Joe Biden get dinged by any of the pack? Will someone have a breakout moment or a candidacy crashing gaffe? Will the debate shake up the polls or shrink the field? You get the idea. We'll have the latest next time, here and now.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Picture this. You go to a hospital, you've paid your copay, and then a bill arrives.
Here at home, I knew, or thought I knew, which hospitals were covered under my insurance.
I'm Molly Wood. The debate around surprise medical bills, next time on Marketplace.
Today at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, Tracy Edwards. In 1989, she led the first all-female crew in the Whitbread Round the World Yacht Race, a grueling 33,000-mile, 9-month-long competition. Journalists predicted this crew wouldn't even finish. The new documentary, Maiden, is about that voyage. Join us. Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Two nights, five moderators, and 20 candidates. But which Democratic hopeful will take on Donald Trump next year? The leading contenders will finally face off on TV. Will they answer the questions you want asked? Reaction to day one of the first 2020 presidential debates, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, more than 6 feet of sea level rise is projected by the end of this century. Of course, that's a long way away, but sea level rise and climate change is a reality now in Northeast Florida. So what's being done to protect life here? WJCT is proud to invite you to explore the answers with us on ADAPT, our new digital magazine, which is less than 24 hours from going live after months of work. Here with more, News Director Jessica Palumbo and reporter Brendan Rivers, who's the lead reporter on adaptflorida.org. Good morning, guys.
Hey, Melissa.
Good morning.
Jessica, let's start with you. What is Adapt Florida? Let's explain what it is.
Yes. Well, as you said, it's 24 hours away at most from launching our coder. Our web person, Ray Hollister, is furiously coding as we speak to get it out the door. And when it does, if you sign up at adaptflorida.org, you will get that notification that it's live. It's a collection of stories. So we're describing it as a digital magazine. It's a curated set of stories. And this really came from a conversation we had here at WJCT about what is one topic that's the most important to really dive deep into. And Melissa, you were the impetus behind this project and saying this is really important and we need to be doing this.
I'm really glad that everybody else agreed. And so let's, Brendan, let's talk about some of the stories that you're covering and all of us will be covering on Adapt Florida. What are you looking at?
So I kind of did, I think it was five sort of deep dives, and Adapt is all about, it's not like kind of these typical climate change stories you hear where it's all doom and gloom and this is how terrible everything's going to be. We're really focusing in on what people are doing to adapt and deal with these changes. So the things that I really dove into was the Navy, so how the Navy is being impacted and what they're doing to deal with these issues. I looked at septic tanks and how they're already causing problems in our waterways and how sea level rise is actually going to exacerbate those issues. I looked at two species of sparrow that are native to Florida and tied that into that recent UN report on how a million different species are in danger of going extinct due to human activity and climate change. I looked at how sea level rise is threatening historic resources, specifically archaeological sites, and what Florida's archaeologists are doing to try to deal with that problem. Mm-hmm. And then I also kind of went back into this ongoing reporting I've been doing on two Jacksonville committees that are addressing the issues of sea level rise and climate change. And I feel like there's one
a lot of stuff. Yeah.
I'd like to say my favorite story you haven't even mentioned is one about real estate in Northeast Florida. And I think it's kind of a buyer's guide. I think this is one that a lot of people are going to be interested in as we are more aware of these issues. And what do we need to know about where we live and if we're looking to buy?
Right. For so many people living in this community, they care about climate change, but they really care about their own address. And so with adaptflorida.org, people can learn more about how their home or business, their location over time, is at risk, in particular of flooding and storm surge. Those are the two big things that a lot of homeowners care about, Brendan. And so you're covering that. And let me ask you as well, what surprised you the most in doing this reporting?
So I was thinking about that this morning. I think it's because I talked to a lot of people when I was working on this, and there was just this kind of common theme that kept coming up. Like, all these people are thinking about this issue and really dealing with how to protect themselves and the things they care about. And they're doing all these great things and they say it's going to help. But really, to address this issue, looking at it long term, there needs to be community buy-in and collective action. Mm-hmm. So as an example, if you raise your home 10 feet and you do everything you can to protect it. So a Category 5 hurricane isn't going to move it. If the community doesn't do that, you're just alone. You're stuck in this house. The roads are flooded. You can't get anywhere. So it really needs to be this collective action. Otherwise, there's going to come a point where you just have to abandon the area.
Right. With all of that said, ADAPT Florida is launching later today. Jessica, how can people learn more so that they get this content as we add to the initial launch of the site?
Right now at adaptflorida.org. Sign up. You will get the notification as soon as it is live, and you'll be able to give feedback as well, because we do consider this the first edition of ADAPT. We'd love to hear from you about your story ideas after you've read it, after you've watched the videos there, after you've done the interactive there to see how your address will fare. After you've experienced all of it, what are your questions? What's your feedback? What would you like to see answered in future editions?
That's right. It's adaptflorida.org. Go to adaptflorida.org right now and just click on the moving waves at the top of the page. You'll be taken to a field where you can opt in to get all of this content when it goes live and all the future updates we're planning here at WJCT. Jessica Palumbo and Brendan Rivers and the whole team here in our newsroom has worked very hard on this. Guys, congratulations, and we hope to be part of this vital conversation for years to come. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. And we want your feedback. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow. We love the earth. It is our home. We love the earth. It is our planet. We love the earth. It is our home. Hi, I'm a baboon. I'm like a man, just less advanced, and my anus is huge.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.